You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach talking American League East with MLB.com's five AL East beat reporters. We're looking at Russell Martin and Dalton Pompey's slow starts and getting a Michael Saunders update when we talk Toronto Blue Jays. Talking Boston Red Sox, taking a look at Clay Buchholz and Justin Masterson, as well as the Mookie Betts phenomenon and the return of Koji Uehara. Talk Rays. We'll be looking at some health updates, taking a look at that impressive bullpen and what might be a surprising offense. Talk Yankees. We'll be taking a look at CC Sabathia, Masahiro Tanaka, and Mark Teixeira's strong start and what they're doing at the back of the bullpen. And we talk Orioles. We'll be talking about Adam Jones's hot start, Matt Wieter's recovery, and Miguel Gonzalez's strong start. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter Brittany Giroli. Brett, Adam Jones is on a tear like we've seen him sometimes have, but to start a season like this is a pretty big deal. What are you seeing from him? Is it just a matter of the ball looking big to him? What's going on that's got him going like this?
You know, I don't know if I've ever seen him like this in terms of just completely locked in at home. And, you know, he's absolutely terrible at actually describing what's going on. He really doesn't worry about that. You know, two games in a row now, we've tried to pepper him after the game with questions. And, you know, I think the only way to describe it is he's a very good young player in baseball coming into his own, and he's going to obviously not keep up this pace by any means, but he's going to have these runs where he can carry this team offensively. And you saw it last year with Nelson Cruz to start the season. Adam Jones is very capable of leading the Orioles. He did it, I think, right around June. He was named Co-AL Player of the Week. So he's had really good runs before. I don't think he's ever been this consistent. And I think if you're the Orioles, you have to be optimistic because of how good his at-bats have been. I mean, we're not talking just home runs here. He's had some really good sacrifice flies. He's had a couple doubles. He's been able to score runs. So he's done a real nice job all around.
Yeah, that's one of the things I kind of wonder about. And it seems like if there's one thing he could do to sort of go from being an excellent player to really being an elite offensive player, it's somehow bolster the power with a few more bases, 280 hitter, nothing wrong with hitting 280, or a few more walks, but somehow become a little bit more of a complete hitter. Now, again, look, as we always say, it's eight games. But do you think there is maybe a year of 300, 310 in him, or, you know, I don't think he's ever going to be a guy that walks a lot, but a guy who maybe finds a way to get on base a little more to bolster all the other things he does?
Maybe, although you kind of hit the nail on the head, he's never going to be a guy that walks a lot. He's never going to be a patient guy. That's part of why you love him, as Buck likes to say all the time. You know, maybe he doesn't hit all those ambush home runs if he's a patient guy. So I think 300 will always be difficult for him. I think the batting average and the consistency of that will always be one of the tougher statistics for him. That being said, there's no reason he can't be in the high twos. There's no reason he can't have a career year. I just don't know if, given the player he is, he's ever going to be that guy who you can count on to get on base, you know, a few times a game.
It would be awfully valuable for them in a year where, again, for a while at least, they are doing without Matt Wieters, in a year where they lost Nelson Cruz. They lost a lot. It would be an awfully big deal if he had a career year in 2015. I'm sure he's not thinking of that, but is he kind of aware? I know he's always been a central player and always been a leader and a core guy there, but is he aware that maybe there's even a little more on him this year?
I think so, and, you know, I've named him a few times, and I think even on his podcast as kind of a key guy that they need this season, that needs to step up. And not that he hasn't done the job, not that he hasn't been a team leader and really the heart of this team. But as you mentioned, I think it's something that is only going to continue to be looked at closer because they don't have that guy anymore. Nelson Cruz obviously was only here for 1 year, but still made a huge impact, particularly with some of the younger players, Manny Machado, Jonathan Scope. And then you look at Nick Markakis, such a quiet leader, a guy who I really am not convinced you can ever replace in the clubhouse in terms of his teammates having the utmost respect for him. So it's definitely big shoes to fill. I don't think they're looking at Adam Jones as trying to be the next Nick Markakis, but I do think that there comes a certain time when you start to mature, you start to have time in the game, that you need to kind of evolve into a little bit more of a leader, and Adam Jones certainly has done that.
change topics a little bit. What's the what is the latest? I mentioned Wieters. What is the latest with him? He's swinging a bat at least. It seems like he's coming along. Where is he at right now?
Yeah, the Royals weren't sure what he was doing today. Yesterday he, as you mentioned, swung the bat. He's in extended spring training. He ended up throwing about 150 feet of you know, long toss. So he continues to build that arm up. Now, mid-June is about the year mark, so I don't know if they're going to be able to hit it by that mark. I don't know if they're targeting maybe him perhaps in the month of May, making some actual rehab starts. But really, the central focus is obviously the arm. The bat was never an issue. He could swing the bat a lot sooner than he could throw. The issue is conditioning that arm, getting him ready again because he was bothered by tendonitis this spring. So I imagine he's going to continue to increase the distance with that throwing. Once they feel like that has gotten to the point where he needs to go on a rehab assignment, he will. They're taking things very slowly, though, because of the nature of the injury of the tendonitis. He needs built-in rest days. So, you know, nothing is imminent on that front, but they're just hoping to have him back as soon as they can.
Are they doing anything differently as he builds up this time than they did in March as he was getting closer as a result of the setback he had in spring training?
I don't think so. I think they kind of expected at some point in time he'd have tendonitis from the throwing. At some point, this is going to happen. I don't think they feel like they pushed it too soon or they did anything wrong. You know, he had no pain. He had passed all the tests, the range of motion tests, and, you know, had built up his arm, all those things. So just a matter of going through that process again and hoping this time that his arm and his elbow and, you know, everything that needs to be in line is in line and is strong enough to handle the withstand of the season.
It's and again, I have to say this nearly every time because we always have to remember it. It is extremely early, but Kevin Gausman, the numbers don't look good, and it's not all in one game. He's walked four guys in three appearances. He's been scored on in every appearance. This guy's a really high-end, exciting pitcher. Is there anything going on there, or is it just a guy having a couple of rough ones and it standing out because it's the beginning of the year?
Yeah, I don't even know if I'd call last night a rough outing. You know, there was an error behind him that was obviously very costly. It caused Zach Britton to come on. It was raining. It wasn't good conditions at all. I wouldn't say he was hit particularly hard. So it's kind of a case, I think, Matthew, of some of the, you know, the fact that it's a few games, the case of the staff being bloated. And, you know, over the course of a season, you have those outings and it's fine. You know, your overall ERA is okay, but when you have them out of the gate, especially an outing like last night, that statistically looks a lot worse than it was, then, you know, you can see why people might be concerned. But Kevin Gausman has pitched okay. I think he hasn't been bad. And last night, quite honestly, if Alejandro Daza makes that catch on the ball that tipped his glove, I don't think we'd be talking about this at all. It's just a case of another run allowed over a very short span. It's kind of the life of a reliever.
Yeah, and another guy I want to ask about in the opposite direction, a guy that's really intrigued me for a while, is Miguel Gonzalez. And you know, his second start was really outstanding. He's a guy, I was looking at his numbers, he's always kind of outperformed his peripherals. He's had fielding independent ERAs like well into the fours and actual ERAs low in the threes. That's unusual, and it's really unusual for a right-hander. A lot of times that's a lefty who's controlling the running game, something like that. What is it that makes him, that makes the end result so much more effective than the strikeout, walk, home run numbers, and really, frankly, more effective than you might even think just from the stuff?
I think it's his makeup. I think a lot has to do with the mental side of the game. Really, no one does it better than Miguel Gonzalez. And there's a reason why he pitches particularly well at Yankee Stadium, at Fenway Park. He rises to the occasion. He's not scared. This is a guy who was a 30-year-old rookie was trying to make their double-A buoy team a few years ago. He's really been a massive success story within the organization about what you can do when you put your mindset to things. And he's really worked hard this spring at that splitter, the pitch that he kind of lived off of. And last night, you can see when he's got the splitter going, he has so much movement there that he's able to do some really nasty things with the ball. And 10 strikeouts isn't a Miguel Gonzalez type of start. But again, he knows every pitch has to be a huge pitch. He said again last night, when you're facing the Yankees, you have to be on your A game. He understands how important divisional games are. He's put on weight. He's done everything the Orioles have asked him to be a more durable pitcher. And his goal now is to go 200 innings. And I'm really glad you brought him up because to me, he's probably one of the best guys on the team in terms of, you know, value. He's very often overlooked. He's a guy that was put in the bullpen for times last year, even though he had a better ERA than pretty much everyone else. He was sent down because he has an option so they could have another guy up and kind of maneuver the roster a little bit better. But he's always been a guy who has been, in my opinion, not as popular and not as well thought of as he should be. And he showed last night exactly why he's so important to the Orioles. I think he's going to have an excellent season.
How did they come across him in the first place? The guy just has an absolutely fascinating career path.
Yeah, they, well, Fred Ferreira, who Dan Duquette hired to be part of their international scouting team, I think it was 2 years ago, I think it was 2012, yes. They were basically scouting. He was in the Mexican Winter League. It was an exhibition game. Miguel Gonzalez came in, 9 pitches, struck out the side, carved them up. Fred Ferreira was like, who is this guy? Ended up signing him to a minor league deal that didn't get done until March. He was never in big league spring training that year. He started in mid-March with Double-A Bowie. So it was just really interesting. He kept outperforming at each level. He came up to the Orioles. They were still a little hesitant. He started off in the bullpen, kept giving everybody out, finally got the chance to start. He really hasn't looked back since. So he's a phenomenal testament, again, of what can happen when you work hard and you just simply never give up.
Brian, you've written about sort of an interesting tension, maybe overstating it, but between the results for CC Sabathia and what the Yankees say they're seeing. And it's interesting for a lot of reasons. One, because he's got a 5.68 ERA and they are preaching optimism, but you look a little deeper and guy does have 15 strikeouts and one walk, which would seem to indicate that ERA probably comes down at some point. To your eye, what are you seeing when Sabathia pitches?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, there's a swing and miss, which is encouraging. And look, I mean, there was a game yesterday where he doesn't move very well off the mound. You can tell this is a guy with a lot of miles on his tires. He's having some trouble covering bases. He's not backing up bases. This is just stuff that the Yankees understand they're going to have to live with. But when he's on the mound, as I said, the swing and miss stuff, the strikeout to walk numbers that you mentioned, that suggests that at some point the luck could turn around. That's what Joe Girardi believes. He thinks that there's been some hard hit balls, but a lot of them have just been ones that fall in. And I guess you'd look at the sample size and you say, I guess that's possible. But at the end of the day, everything that he's doing is not stopping runs from coming across home plate. So I don't want to pour a whole lot of sunshine on it and say everything's fantastic because, look, he's got 2 losses and you know that those are hung on him for a reason. But last night, he didn't get a whole lot of run support. Maybe if he had gotten more, he could have been in the game or at least gotten a no decision. I think there's encouraging signs there. Certainly, he does look better than he did last season when he was just getting bombed around the ballpark and giving up home runs. And the year before that, the home run ball was a problem, too. So he's made it through 2 starts. Adam Jones is red hot. He hit one out last night. But other than that, he's kept the ball in the yard. And I think that's probably the most encouraging thing you can say about him.
He's also got 12 2/3 innings in 2 April starts, and I think if you knew nothing else and you said CC's going to average 6 1/3 innings a start this year, and that number of starts was 28, 29 or more, the Yankees would probably be pretty happy with that, almost knowing nothing else. I mean, you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely, and he's the first Yankee starter this year to get through 7 innings, so I don't think a lot of people probably would have picked that out of spring training. Look, he had a rough spring. He got beat up, and there was a day where he basically said it is one of the only times I've ever heard CC curse in a group setting, and he said, you know, basically, I'll clean it up for him. I don't care about spring results. They don't matter. I think that he's at the point in his career now where he knows what he needs to do. He's not going to be the 95-mile-an-hour guy. He's working more 88, 89. He's got to spot the fastball. As I said, he's got to keep the ball in the yard. He's that kind of pitcher. But the breaking stuff has created some swings and misses. He's been pretty heavy on the slider. The slider has looked good. It bites down in the zone. It's fooling hitters. It's getting strikeouts. You know, those are all encouraging things for CC. So I think that and the fact that he's healthy and he said there's been no problems with his knee, that gives the Yankees some confidence that he can actually be on the mound every fifth day and play a big part for them this year.
There also seemed to be some increased optimism over Masahiro Tanaka's second start. Again, the results were not great, but it seemed like people were pretty pleased. How did he look to you in his second start?
Better, and here's why, because he reared back and he threw the fastball a little bit more. That first start was kind of curious because he really hadn't pitched that way all spring training. So it kind of lends some credence to the fact of what he said that day, and that that was part of the game plan against the Blue Jays, and he just knew the fastball was going to get hit, so he kind of made an in-game adjustment with Brian McCann. Against the Red Sox, more fastballs, attacked the zone a little more. I think you would have liked to have seen him. He had a big lead. He had 7 runs in the first inning. You would have liked to have seen him challenge hitters a little more. He worked too many deep counts. I asked Girardi about that, and he said, well, you want the pitcher to be true to who he is. So in that way, he was okay with the fact that Tanaka didn't pitch to the scoreboard and kind of just threw some fastballs and hoped that line drives get hit at guys. So they got 5 innings out of him. You would like to see Tanaka work a little deeper into the game, especially if he's going to be up near 95, 100 pitches. So that's something to work on the next time out, I think.
Play another round of ninth inningology with the Yankees. You have written that this continues to appear to be appears to have taken shape, even if nobody's actually admitting it. Do you think that's an accurate way to put it, that there pretty much is a ninth inning guy, even if they won't actually admit it?
I think at this point they're keeping the door open to allow Dellin Betances to come in at some point. They're not telling Betances he is not the closer, but every way he's been utilized by Joe Girardi tells you that Andrew Miller is the closer. And look, Betances had a shaky spring that has carried over into the regular season. He's given up some hits. It hasn't been easy for him to get out of those innings. Meanwhile, Miller has just been lights out. He has yet to give up a hit, I believe. Miller has made the decision very easy for the Yankees to give him the ball in the ninth inning. I think that on days when Miller's not available, last night would have been one of them if it was a save situation. Betances would have gotten the call last night. But other than that, there's really no reason right now not to give the ball to Andrew Miller when you need 3 outs and you're away from shaking hands.
The other interesting part of that, though, and the thing that I actually found at least as interesting as when Joe Girardi initially said, hey, we might not designate a guy, was he also said, hey, these guys could go 4 or 5 outs, and we saw that recently. We saw Miller get a save of more than 3 outs. Do you think that's still on the table? Even if he's not creative about who finishes the game, do you think the ways in which he uses these two guys might still be a little bit unconventional?
Absolutely, and this is something that Girardi really likes. He does matchups anyway. Pretty much throughout the game. He was saying, you do this all the time with your relievers from the 6th through the 8th, so what's the real difference with the 9th? I know, obviously, he's had Mariano Rivera and Rafael Soriano and David Robertson, and those were his 9th inning guys, and it was so easy to say 3 outs away, give the ball to them, especially with Mo. But in this situation, it's kind of a different landscape. It's something that the Yankees are happy to be trying here. It doesn't necessarily mean it has to be that way the entire year, but for example, that the first game in Baltimore, he was hoping to get a few more outs out of Betances. It didn't work out. He got in some trouble. The pitch count got up. So, yeah, you can go to Andrew Miller and get a 5-out save. Neither one of these guys has ever closed on a regular basis in the big league, so it's not like they have any claim to the role. There's no real ego involved with it. It is unconventional, but you've got two guys who are proven late-inning relievers who can get outs late, but have never closed. So you can really do pretty much whatever you want with them.
Tell me if I'm nuts here. And really, do tell me if I'm nuts here. Girardi he's gotten a lot of ribbing. There's been the sort of Twitter jokes about the binder. It's my opinion and impression that this guy's actually a really savvy handler of a bullpen. That he'll make missteps like anybody. But to my eye, he is one of the more thoughtful, sometimes creative, not quite crazy, but I think he's a really good handler of a bullpen. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think it's something that he puts a big priority on. Ever since his first year managing with the Yankees, he's been very strict about how to best use a guy and make sure you don't blow guys out. He has a strict rule where he refuses to use a guy 3 days in a row. Joe keeps a card in his pocket during games where every pitcher is listed, and some of those guys have red lines marked right through them, and they are absolutely off limits. And I don't think that's unheard of in the game, but he really makes that a point. He stresses that point. And you've seen it late in the year where You go into late September and maybe you're fighting for a playoff spot, and then maybe you can relax those rules a little bit. But Girardi has said many times that he doesn't want to be responsible for having a guy's career on his hands. And you know, people in the Yankee world talk about how, for example, Joe Torre blew out Scott Proctor, some of those other guys from the mid-2000s. You know, there are guys where it's just Torre went to the bullpen so much, and if you pitch a guy into the ground, so be it. That's what they're there for. Guys like Paul Quantrill, I can think of. You know, I can throw a bunch of baseball cards from the mid-2000s at you. I think that's really something that Girardi has made a priority out of, and then the Yankees bullpen seems to be better for it.
Let's do a little bit of overreacting, because we haven't really done any of that just yet. The line looks pretty good from Mark Teixeira, 3 home runs early. Do you think maybe there's, if not one of those MVP caliber years, one more really good year left in him?
Well, he always talks about 30 and 100, and you know, he hasn't been able to get there in quite a while. I don't necessarily think that this is going to be the year, but the Yankees would surely sign up for, I don't know, 25 and 85. I mean, the biggest thing with Teixeira is staying on the field, as we know. But if you look back at the history of guys who have had similar wrist injuries, and I'm thinking of David Ortiz and Jose Bautista most prominently, usually it takes them a full year to come back. And that was that year last year for Teixeira, where you're on the field, but there's always a thought that there might be a nagging injury here, and kind of aches, and you have to do a lot of maintenance. This should be the year where that wrist is back to normal. Now, that's not saying that some other ailment won't pop up. There's always a hamstring or a calf or something with Teixeira. Anything could be right around the corner. But as far as that wrist is concerned, he should have that power back. I think it's interesting that all 3 of his home runs have come from the right side of the plate. You know, you'd like to see him turn that on from the left side now, and especially considering where Yankee Stadium's dimensions are and how he's built for that park. But, no, certainly a good sign. It took him until the end of April last year to hit 3 home runs. He's already got 1 through 7 games, 8 games here. So I think the Yankees are happy knowing that he's in the order. And they've been talking about how, look, it's not just the home runs. They need a fly ball, a sacrifice fly. Teixeira's a guy who has done that in his career. He can do it. He has done it already this year. You've seen that. So, he's a guy that pitchers certainly cannot look past in the lineup. You still have to work around Mark Teixeira.
Rigger, things are going pretty well here in the early going for the Blue Jays. It's kind of an odd team. Some guys that we thought would hit aren't. Some guys that we thought might not are. The thing that stands out most in the early going, or at least one of the things, is Russell Martin is having a rough time. Do you think this is one of those things that we see sometimes where a new contract is a burden? Do you think it's just sometimes a guy has a bad week? What are you seeing from Russell Martin?
I think he might be pressing a little bit. You know, we talked to him just last night on Tuesday night about that. And he certainly denied it. He doesn't think there's anything to it. He thinks it's just one of those stretches. He's had plenty of them before in his career, and he thinks everything's going to be fine. But, you know, from what I think a lot of us have seen, is I think he is pressing a little bit. And, you know, I think part of that is coming over with the big contract. But I think the other part is, you know, he's got an awful lot of responsibilities on his plate right now. I mean, trying to learn an entirely new pitching staff. You know, one of those includes a knuckleball, which is something he hasn't done before in his career. It's a very difficult thing to do. I think there is just so much emphasis on him working with the pitching staff that there just wasn't a whole lot of time for him to do a lot of the normal hitting that he would do. And I think he's just trying to work through some of those things right now. And I think the fact that he doesn't get the results early, I think that just adds to it a little bit. But in the end, I think he'll be fine. I don't necessarily think you're going to see an offensive year like he had last year in Pittsburgh. That's very hard to go back to. But I think when it's all said and done, he'll just be fine offensively, and the Jays will get something close to what they're expecting.
This may be the ignorance of an outsider, and so I really am asking as much as speculating. Is the fact I realize it's not home. He's from another place entirely. But the fact that these free agents signing to a big deal of not just a key player but a Canadian player, does that add any way to the stress, to the pressure on him to perform, or is that making too much of something that's not there?
I mean, it could, but I think the fact you look at his track record and going through very tough markets like playing for the Yankees, playing for the Dodgers, I mean, he's been through the tough times before, where there, I don't think you can get much more pressure than been playing for the Yankees in New York, where, you know, it really is kind of the center of the baseball universe at times. You know, there's no question that when he came up here and since he's been here, that there's been nonstop demand for him from the media. And it's not just English, it's also the French media coming in. And, you know, I've marveled at the patience he's had with a lot of reporters throughout the past several weeks, just because there has been so much demand on him. And there's no question that eventually would take a toll on somebody just having to so many off-the-field responsibilities. But I think he just needs to break out of the slump. And then once that happens, I think everything will be fine. But there certainly is, probably not surprisingly, a moderate level of panic from Blue Jays fans already when they see a guy who's exceeded an 0-for-20 skid at the plate.
We will get to some good news shortly, I swear. But another guy who's scuffling is Dalton Pompey. And, you know, it's a little different when you've got a guy with a long track record and a guy who's really never shown it consistently in the big leagues. What's the level of concern? Again, very few games, but over his slow start.
Yeah, I think the thing he has to be the most concerned about is Kevin Pillar has played really, you know, surprisingly very well at the start of this year. Originally, you looked at Pillar as probably the fourth outfielder on this team. You know, Michael Saunders going down opened up a starting job for him, so he slid into left field. But Kevin Pillar is a guy who can play center as well. So, you know, the way Pillar is playing right now, it's going to be awfully tough to take him out of the lineup. You know, a lot of people have been asking what's going to happen when Michael Saunders comes back. Well, originally, all along, I was saying that Pillar would slide back into that fourth outfielder spot, but he certainly could push Dalton Pompey for playing time, especially if, you know, these small sample sizes, if they continue to play out over the next week or so before Saunders returns. I mean, that's something that really, really could happen, because Pillar's a guy who doesn't have much of a track record either, but he's a little bit more experienced in the big leagues. He provides very good defense, and if the Blue Jays can get some stuff out of his bat, then potentially they might have to make a move with Pompey. But I think the same thing with Pompey as I did with Martin. You know, I think he's pressing a little bit. I think you look up at the scoreboard and you see your numbers as low as they are, and I think that you can't help but put a little extra pressure on yourself.
And the question I would have with Pompey is, if Pillar starts eating into his playing time, and when Saunders comes back, is he a guy they would keep on not playing regularly, or would they send him down to play regularly and continue developing?
I would think you would have to send him down. I just don't think you want to have a promising prospect like that up in the major leagues just playing once or twice a week. I think for the most part, you got to make a commitment that you're going to give him a significant amount of playing time. Otherwise, you send him down. And I think that it certainly hasn't got to that point yet. That would be kind of a big step back for him and his career, because you just never really know how some guys are going to respond. I think he would get a little bit more time than that. Maybe you would see the two of them find a way to platoon in the first little bit. But if it ever comes to the point where Kevin Pillar is getting the majority of the playing time in center field, I don't think there's any question that you'd have to send him down so you can continue to get regular bats, because the last thing you want to have happen is for his development to be stopped in any kind of way.
How is Saunders coming along? There was a little setback there recently. Is what's the time frame on that looking like?
Yeah, that was the first bad news that he's had in a little while. It seemed like everything was progressing really, really, really well, and then he felt something in his right hamstring, and it was just some tightness. Didn't seem to be anything severe, and it's on a different leg than the one that was surgically repaired, and that's perhaps not surprising, because sometimes you try to overcompensate a little bit in those first days back, and if you're trying to protect your left leg, then sometimes it's your right leg that ends up getting hurt, and that was the case in this situation. But it doesn't seem to be anything severe. It does push a timeline back. You know, I would think at least a week, even if he only misses a couple of days, because it's going to get him out of his routine. And this is still a guy who's only played left field once so far, and the tight hamstring happened right after that appearance with Class A Dunedin. So he's going to have to play at least a couple of games back-to-back, nine innings in left field before he can really come back. And so you're probably talking about at least another week, but in terms of him being off the field, he should be back any day.
One of the pieces of good news in the early going is the bullpen, which we talked a lot about as a worry. Very early, has looked pretty good. I think there was one stumble in the first week. But overall, they've been pretty effective. What are you seeing from those guys?
Yeah, it really is, you know, the young guy so far that you know, we spent a lot of time talking about in the spring. Miguel Castro has been a big pleasant surprise for them so far. Roberto Osuna. Basically, what they were hoping to get from those two out of spring training is what they've gotten so far in the regular season. And now it's a really, really interesting mix down there because you don't have a traditional closer. You know, Gibbons has talked in the past about not wanting to go to a bullpen by committee, but that's essentially what he has right now. I mean, Cecil started off as a closer and it lasted all of one appearance before they took it away from him. And then they basically went to Miguel Castro. But you look at a situation like earlier this week in Tuesday night's game against the Rays, it was a tie ball game, 2-2 in the seventh inning, and Gibbons wasn't afraid to go to Castro. And I think a lot of times it's really going to be based on where the lineup is. I think if there's the heart of the order and there's some lefties coming up, it doesn't matter what the inning is. If it's a late game situation, you're going to see Brett Cecil. If it's a late game situation, you know, you're going to see Miguel Castro if there's some right-handers coming up. So there's no egos involved here. There's no one who's been named, you know, the track record of a closer who's had it for a few years who would be incredibly upset if they got pulled from the closer role. These are guys who have never really had that role before. So I think everyone embraces the opportunities when they come along. But I think everyone down there is understanding that on any given night, it could be, you know, anywhere from one to three guys who would get that safe chance.
I did want to ask you specifically about Cecil, who that first outing got a lot of attention and really kind of scared some people and apparently directly led to some changes in the structure of that bullpen. And yet, as we speak now, in his two appearances since then, the numbers at least have been pretty good. Is that sharpness coming back? Has he looked better as the lines have reflected, or is he still kind of feeling around a little bit?
He looked a lot better in that second game after that first one in New York. Just the velocity was down so much. I mean, it was down to like 87. He hit 88 once, and just the crispness on his pitches, the breaking ball, nothing was there. I mean, he looked like a guy who basically just started spring training, to be honest with you. And then the second outing, he came back right away. Even though there was so much concern going into that second game, he came back in the second game and the velocity was up a little bit. Not quite where he wants it to be, but it was around 91, which isn't far off. He's kind of a 92, 93 guy, so he was topping out about two less than what he normally would. And the curveball was there, and that's really his bread and butter pitch. And so really, he kind of turned things around, I think, a lot quicker than, you know, any of the media thought, and even anybody on his own team, I think, thought that he was going to be able to do. Perhaps the Jays wouldn't have made the change that they did if they knew he was going to come back that strongly, that fast. But I think the fact is they do like kind of having multiple options down there. But it's an encouraging sign because Brett Cecil is a very, very key piece of that bullpen. It doesn't matter if he's pitching the ninth inning, the eighth inning, or the seventh inning. He's a guy who they're going to go to during some high leverage situations.
Bill, it's been a pretty nice start for the Rays so far. They're not running away with anything, but they're winning some games. If you had to put it down to one thing, why is this team winning in the early going?
Well, to answer your question in a second, but also if you put that into perspective, they're winning games while they're trying to stay afloat with their all of their injuries. So right now it's been starting pitching. They've, you know, got their main three, which is Jake Odorizzi, Chris Archer, and Nathan Carnes. And they've done a nice job. And then they've done a nice job of bobbling their bullpen in there when they haven't had one of those main three guys. So that's turned out well for them, and they've come up with some timely hits. You know, of course, Kevin Kiermaier has given them a lot of energy. Right now they just look really good.
Couple guys continue to make their way back that would make a big difference for this team. First, can you give us an update on Drew Smyly? I guess he made a second rehab start. What's the situation with him?
He made a second rehab start yesterday. Everything looked good. Earlier we were asking, there had been some discussion of whether or not they'd try and bring him back once he'd reached 75 pitches. Now they're saying he's going to be totally stretched out. Provided everything goes well, you could probably pencil him in to start April 29th in Yankee Stadium in a day game. But you know, who knows? You never know. But he has not had any setbacks, so you're optimistic about that.
And then Alex Cobb, how's he coming along?
You know what? They're not saying much about that. All they've said is he's playing catch. He's not on a mound yet, so, you know, to me that kind of sends up a little bit of a red flag, but we'll have to wait and see once they give us a little more information.
What kind of program is he supposed to be on? Where should he be right now as far as coming back from his injury?
Well, you know, with tightness in his forearm, and you know, and this was early in spring training. I mean, they had already started playing games, but you would have thought by now, you know, they would have let the tendonitis quiet down some. He started playing catch, then you would assume that he would already be on a mound by now. So, you know, I don't know if they're just being overly cautious or if it's just maybe it's something a little more serious than what they're saying. But right now, again, it's kind of like, in my mind, it's kind of a red flag.
Is it reasonable to think at this point, given how long he's been down and how little spring he has, that once he is on a mound, you're still probably talking easily a good month before he's pitching in big league games? I mean, this is not a guy I would think that's just going to need a couple of starts and get right out there.
No, and that's a good question. We've asked to Cash before, and you know a week or so ago they were saying no. Well, he had a good part of spring training. He'd gotten ready, so they didn't think he was going to need as long as Smiley. But the longer this thing goes, the more it's going to take for him to come back.
Well, meanwhile, the in addition to the starters, the bullpen seems to have been pretty effective early. Is that kind of shaking out as expected as far as the roles, as far as who's pitching where?
Well, you know, they said they were not going to come up, you know, name a closer. But for the most part, that guy has been Brad Boxberger so far. Jepson looked good last night closing up. Of course, the big concern is if they have too many nights like last night and what they had Friday night in Miami, it takes them a while to recover from that when their starter goes short. So I think they have a nice bullpen, and it's going to be even better once Jake McGee comes back. But the concern is that it gets, you know, too many innings, and then you get to a situation where you're not able to use them in matchups and stuff like that. You're using them more to, you know, kill extra innings.
That seems a particular challenge for a first-year manager. I mean, if there's one thing that is consistently difficult for any manager, it's handling a bullpen. But how do you see Kevin Cash in the early days when it comes to managing a bullpen?
Well, I think he leans heavily on his pitching coach, Jim Hickey, who's one of the best in the business. So, I don't think he's really missed too much right now. Again, he's not afraid to, or he doesn't seem to be afraid to ask for help. And he's very open about that. So, the bullpen's in good hands with Hickey's advice, I think.
On the offensive side, they're not lighting up the scoreboard, but they're proven to be, in the early going, a pretty good offensive team. Do you think maybe there's more to this offense than we thought? Is there reason to think that this might be, if not a juggernaut, at least a decent offense?
Well, I think it could be decent. You know, and one thing so far they've proved to be, while they seem to have pretty, you know, can work a pretty good at bat, they're not afraid to be aggressive. And I think when you have that kind of approach, the pitcher out there knows you are ready to strike if he's given something to hit, as opposed to just guys watching balls come in there and, you know, you can throw them in there. So, for example, right now they've walked 6 times with the bases loaded. So I do think they have a chance to be a little better offensively than what we thought. And, of course, part of that, too, is, they've had an upgraded catcher with Rivera. And Cabrera's swinging the bat pretty well at shortstop, too. So those are both fairly significant. And then Sousa suddenly seems to be, I shouldn't say suddenly, but last night had a good night. So that could bode well for the, you know, coming week or two if he got a little bit hot.
At the risk of scouting the stats here, which is always dangerous, I'm looking at Evan Longoria's line. I haven't seen him hit much this year yet, unfortunately. But looking at his line, And despite the 192 average, it seems like there's a lot to like. He has taken his walks. He's got four extra base hits. Has he looked pretty good at the plate to you?
I think so. And, you know, I think he's one of those guys you just don't worry about. He's going to hit. I think it's going to help, too, the fact that they've moved Desmond Jennings back there behind him and, you know, some of their lineup variations with Jennings and Souza. Jennings so far has been, you know, pretty strong at the bat. So I would think that, you know, we're going to see Longoria come along here pretty soon.
And then to go back to the rotation, is this as day by day as it appears as far as piecing together the back of the rotation, or is there more of a clear plan that they're not letting on, or they really are kind of doing this thing almost day by day for the back of the rotation?
Well, you never know what goes on in the back shop, you know, the clandestine things of a major league operation. But for our purposes and observing it, it's about as day-to-day as it gets. I mean, they didn't even announce tonight's starter until after last night's game. So, that might have been primarily because they might have used Erasmo Ramirez last night. Of course, they have announced him to start. Option Kirby Yates who pitched last night, so I'm expecting them to bring up maybe C.J. Riefenhauser or Jose Dominguez, you know, who are both on the 40-man. I'd be surprised if it wasn't one of those two coming up tonight. But you know, right now it looks like they're every other night after those main three, they're kind of flying by the seat of their pants. Although I thought Andrés had a nice start last night, and he might be able to shake it out next time when they hit the number four spot.
Ian, let's start with the health updates. Got a couple of guys with what seem to be minor injuries. How are Xander Bogaerts and Pablo Sandoval?
Yeah, fortunately, Bogaerts is okay, and he was really the one they were a little concerned about. I mean, they were concerned enough with Bogaerts' knee that they had him get an MRI when he had some swelling after their home opener. Everything came out fine, clean. Made a quick two, only missed one game, and Sandoval got hit in the foot. That was a little bit of a scare when you see the big man crumple to the ground there for a second, but he bounced back well also, and is he's a full go. So couldn't have asked for anything better considering the scare they had earlier in the week.
We seem to talk about him every week, but he seems to take a different turn every week. Clay Buchholz followed a really encouraging first start with a not very encouraging second start. I know we don't want to overreact to things in April, but with that said, this was exactly what they didn't want to see, was following up a good one with a bad one and bringing up those worries of inconsistency. What did you see from Buchholz in his second start, and was it at all worrisome?
Yeah, it was a little worrisome in the sense that, you know, once things started to go wrong for Buchholz at Yankee Stadium, he couldn't stop the bleeding. And you'd like to think that he's at the point now where, and that's what we talked about a little bit in spring training, where he can see some bumps in the road and sort of minimize the damage. And giving up seven runs in the first inning, you know, certainly isn't minimizing the damage. And, you know, I would have liked to have seen after the game, you know, Buchholz just to be a little more like, you know, I stunk. But instead it was kind of like, you know, I got unlucky, some bad breaks here or there. I just think it might be good for him to sort of confront it a little more head on than to just try to chalk it up as bad luck.
And likewise, Justin Masterson followed a good one with a rough one. Again, we're kind of left with nothing but overreacting because it's the middle of April. But, you know, Masterson, I think, is a guy that probably is going to be watched awfully closely because he's coming off a bad year. He might be the guy that might be kind of first on the chopping block once one of the starters are ready, one of the kid starters are ready. What did you see from him in his second start, and how closely is he being watched? I'm sure he's not on a short leash now, but is it fair to say he might be the first guy to be on a short leash at some point?
Yeah, maybe at some point, but I think they honestly feel pretty good about where Masterson is headed. He pitched a really good first game in Philadelphia, and then against the Nationals, you know, he was pretty good for the first few innings there, and then just seemed to run out of gas, and you know, things kind of sped up on him there. But you know, a good sign to me is, you know, Masterson had a few fastballs in that game against the Nationals that were at 95 miles an hour, which is clear, you know, he was throwing a couple years ago when he was so good. So I just think they still feel that he's getting it back a little bit after such a disjointed year last year, where maybe, you know, some of his mechanics got got screwed up a little bit. But, yeah, I think they're actually, despite, you know, one bad inning he's had so far, I think they're actually pretty encouraged by where he's headed right now.
Okay, that's already too much negative about a team that has looked really impressive so far. If there's one thing that it comes down to that they've been so successful early, what would be one thing you would point to?
Well, I think that they are really grinding pitchers into the ground, and you know, I saw a stat that through the first eight games of the season, that you know, Aaron Harang is the only guy who had pitched into the sixth inning against the Red Sox this season, and that's just a sign that their offense is really grinding out every at bat, and that's always what the Red Sox have done when they've been good, is just grind pitchers into the ground a little bit, and they've done that so far this year.
Is this offense essentially kind of what people expected? I mean, it seems like that's sort of what they thought they had, was, as much as anything else, an offense that goes nine deep.
Yeah, not only is this offense pretty good 1-9, but really you can go down to three guys on the bench there with Brock Holt and with Daniel Nava and with Alan Craig. I mean, a lot of teams would love to have three guys like that sitting around on the bench. You saw the game at Yankee Stadium last week where the Red Sox decided, hey, let's sit our entire starting outfield today. And, Craig, Dava, and Holt all played the outfield and all helped them win that game. So they're pretty excited about what they could do as an offense this year.
We're all kind of freaking out about Mookie Betts, and with good reason. He has a fun name. He's a fun player to watch. He's got some tools. How good do you think he really is this year? I mean, we're probably not talking MVP for this guy. Do you think he's a star player at the end of this year? Do you think he's a good player at the end of this year? Putting aside the long term, what do you think at the end of this year we're looking at as the kind of player Mookie Betts is in 2015?
Yeah, I think we're looking at about a guy who can hit about 280 with 10 to 15 homers, you know, drive in 60 to 65 runs, score. You know, he's going to score 100 in this lineup. He's going to play good defense. He's probably going to steal 30 bases. So you're looking at a pretty good player. I don't know. I think eventually he could become a great player. I mean, when you hear David Ortiz say the other day, like, Mookie Betts is going to be a superstar. You know, it kind of says something. But, I think you don't want to expect too much too soon coming out of that for Mookie. But I think he's definitely in position to have a very solid year this year.
It sounds to me like you just described early career Jacoby Ellsbury. I realize they're not the same player. But is there something of a parallel there?
Yeah, no, it's a great comparison. I do think that there's a lot of similarity there between Betts and Ellsbury, given the skill set. I think that Mookie's a little more charismatic, a little more fun to watch in a way than Ellsbury, but definitely numbers wise, if he could do what Jacoby Ellsbury did for the team for a long time and stay healthy, they'd be very happy with what they have in Mookie Betts. The exciting thing is still that he's 22 years old with a limited amount of experience, and already he's showing us some of the things he's showing, and he really, the thing that continues to impress me is he hits the pitcher's pitch. He's always on time hitting, and that's the guy who trends to be a good player.
He clearly has the tools to be a really good center fielder. He doesn't have much experience there. To your eye, just watching him now, I mean, obviously he is a spectacular center fielder. I mean, in that he makes the spectacular play.
Yeah.
Do you think he is a plus overall center fielder right now? And where do you think what kind of development do you think he has as a defensive player at a relatively new position?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the guy who made the play he did on Bryce Harper with only a year of experience in the outfield. I mean, that's pretty special. But at the same time, he's still learning too. Where he's, he made a over aggressive throw at Yankee Stadium the other night that might have cost him a run. So still learning little nuances like that. But yeah, I mean, right now he already has plus range. Yeah, he has a pretty good arm, and he's only going to get better out there. But eventually, I think he could become a Gold Glove type guy. But right now, he's from what I see every day, he's definitely plus out there in center.
For a team that was already going pretty well, it was nice to be able to add Koji Uehara quickly. Did he look like he always looked in his first big league game back?
Right, except for one, Koji made one bad pitch that he said he just didn't get any power behind, and that was the one that Ryan Zimmerman very nearly hit over the wall to tie the game and ended up going foul. But I saw some really good splitters from Koji, the kind that he lacked at the end of last year, the kind that Red Sox fans were used to in 2013 and the first 3-4 months of 2014. I mean, he made Bryce Harper look really bad on a splitter. So very encouraging sign with Koji in his first game back. You just hope that he's 40 years old. You hope his health holds up over the full season. Maybe down the long run, these couple weeks he missed it, this week or so he missed at the beginning of the season, maybe that will help him because, you know, he saved a few bullets for the end.
I know we already talked about this, but I kind of want to revisit it now that he is actually back, and this is a real question that will be answered on a day-to-day basis. How gingerly are they going to handle him as far as frequency of use and kind of whether they might look even to other options in the ninth if they've used him a good bit recently?
Yeah, I think they're really going to pick their spots with Koji this year, realizing that you can't run this guy into the ground, and you want to preserve him as best you can. I mean, will he pitch back-to-back days with a one-run lead? I'm sure he will. But will they try to avoid pitching 3 days in a row? Yeah, I think they're going to try to avoid that for the most part. But they'll just do their best to monitor it as they're going to see how he's responding. But, yeah, really be conscious of conserving this guy because he's really important to this team over the long haul.
All right, well, Ian Brown, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.